You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 12th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Clever publishing in changing formats, designing the covers and layouts that tell a whole new story. Beautifully bound and teeming with springtime surprises, one independent magazine seems to have it all covered. This week we take a look at an indie title that's invested in high quality design and graphics, and it really shows. Printed Pages magazine has also kept the editorial lead with stories and a unique approach that sets it apart from the rest. We'll be joined by the editors. Plus we'll be heading to Greece's second city to hear the discussion coming out of a journalism conference that seems to make sense of an industry in transition.
As society is losing more and more faith in the traditional institutions of school, family, churches, as these institutions cease to provide this orientation, the media take over.
We'll also be heading to the Alps to see what our editor-in-chief has to say about design publishing. All that and plenty more besides on this 85th edition of The Stack, our dedicated print industry review and analysis show, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House in London. You're listening to Monocle 24 and this is The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now, there are certain magazines on the programme that seem to always get our juices flowing. Last month we heard from one such, The Gentlewoman, with its editor Penny Martin. And now it's the turn of a very different but equally beautiful favourite on the programme to get a little of the limelight. Printed Pages is the magazine offshoot of the influential It's Nice That website. The recently launched spring issue with its striking but delicate front cover has certainly had the print world talking. Today I'm lucky to be joined by two of the men who make Printed Pages possible. Rob Alderson, editor-in-chief, welcome back to The Stack. And for his debut appearance, we welcome James Cartwright, who has a special interest in Printed Pages graphic design and illustrations, amongst all the other elements too. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start then. Well, let's talk about Printed Pages first of all, because it's a regular pick of our guests, and everyone is a fan. Tell me a little bit about the sort of the broad creative vision. I know we've probably talked about this before, Rob, but it's a little bit of a different mix, I guess, of illustration, reportage, the kind of things that you do. Tell us about how it generally sort of comes together.
So the big challenge with Printed Pages, I think, is that it has to maintain the DNA of It's Nice That. It has to feel consistent. The people who are aware of our brand already understand that. But what we're very keen on, why we stopped It's Nice That magazine and relaunched it as Printed Pages last year, was because we were excited about this pushing it in new directions, finding ways that we could still tell stories about illustration, graphic design, photography, art, and anything else that kind of tickles our fancy, but doing it in a way that is much more suited to print, and that we can do it in much more depth and do it, you know, in different and exciting visual ways. So that's kind of the overarching vision of it, I suppose. What's interesting maybe about this issue is that, you know, we did four issues last year that were staple bound, were smaller, illustrated front covers, and this really represents the new generation already. You know, after just four issues, we've kicked it up again for this issue. It's perfect bound. We've added about 45 pages pagination, I think, something like that. It's a much weightier, heftier thing, but I hope that once you get into it, it still feels fun, it still feels enthusiastic, it still has those recognisable It's Nice That traits, which we're so kind of committed to.
Let's talk then a little bit about the cover art, because it's always an important decision, isn't it? You know, the sort of impact you make on newsstand. Talk to us a little bit about the spring cover.
We're quite sort of loose in terms of how we brief the cover. So, I mean, this year we've opted to kind of go commission based on season. So we've given quite a loose brief, commissioned an Italian still life photographer called Maurizio Diorio. And essentially we just sort of went to him with a very small selection of images that he'd already produced that were sort of in keeping with what we were going for, you know. Simple plain colour in the background, sort of isolated image, and then kind of gave him free rein. So it was more about his sort of personal interpretation of what spring was. And so we kind of went back and forth for a long time, kind of like fresh cut flowers, all of these sort of strange combinations of colours and objects that, I don't know, sort of evolved over time, and we weren't necessarily sure with it at the start. And I think It's probably our most striking cover to date. It's certainly been the most well received. But it is quite a sort of slow evolution.
I think that idea of evolution is really interesting, though. I remember seeing Tyler speak at the Modern Magazine conference last year, and he talked about the common denominators that had been kind of delineated about successful monocle covers, and it was beards, dogs, and glasses, I think, were among them. And that was great.
They do tend to appear now and again.
I realise, looking around, we're low glass and beards now in this room. But what he said, that there is this X factor. I think what's amazing, like you say, you know, once we got to it, that we liked the orange and the egg setup, we had probably 6 or 7 versions of it on the wall, and, you know, one was the one we've gone, which has the kind of the orange leaf touching the egg. One had a couple of eggs laid out next to the orange. And what's weird is that for some reason, one speaks to you in a way that, you know, it's all an orange and an egg, and it's various combinations of that. And it's funny why visually some of them, viscerally or emotively, you respond to them and others you don't. And I think it's an ongoing thing that you just have them all on the wall and you live with them for a bit, and suddenly you go, yeah, it's the orange hugging the egg, that's the right one, which makes you sound mad, but, you know, we're really pleased.
It's a fine line between insanity and genius, I always find, especially in the world of magazines. I'm with Rob Alderson and James Cartwright. They're talking about printed pages, of course, but we're also going to delve into an extensive and impressive stack of magazines that the gents have brought with them today. Maybe let's start with one each. James, do you want to kick us off with something? Where will we begin our roundup today?
Yeah, sure thing. Let us begin with the new edition of Colours. It's issue number 89, and it's focusing on moving house. I've got sort of a long-standing love of Colours. I think it's incredibly good at digesting extremely complex world issues and kind of making them seem very relevant and boiling them down into sort of constituent parts that you can really understand. So, you know, there's kind of features in there on sort of Gaza and quite heavyweight sort of political issues that you get a sense of in daily news and modern press, but it kind of very much humanizes it and puts things in these stories into context that you can really understand. And does so sort of with incredible supporting imagery as well. I always think that this is one magazine that's really on point with the photography that they commission and the stories that they run. But it's run by Patrick Waterhouse, and since he's been editor-in-chief there, he's sort of turned Colours into these guides, and this is still kind of continuing that theme. But yeah, I think that sort of really quick, digestible content on these sort of quite heavyweight issues is really, really nice.
Well, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because you need to have that lightness of touch. And yet, as you say, you're dealing with some very heavyweight issues. And that is a challenge, isn't it, Rob, to sort of convey the complexity that James is talking about there, but to have that sort of levity without being, you know, without sort of being superficial. And Patrick Waterhouse is certainly very, very good at it. Even going back to, this was a previous issue that I'm leafing through here with looking at news, just incredible pictures. What do you make of the actual the way the magazine is really put together, with these sort of inserts and the, you know, bold sort of subdivided images? They have pages that have, you know, frames cut out of them looking through to images on the pages. It never seems to lapse into sort of gimmickry. It always seems to work very effectively. But that's quite another quite sort of delicate balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the point is that you can do interesting things with design, but as soon as that starts to obfuscate or obstruct your enjoyment of the content or your access to the content, that's where design has gone too far. And I think it's something we talk an awful lot about printed pages. You know, what are the things that we can do that are simple and interesting and engaging visually, but don't take you away, don't distract you? And I think what Patrick and his team do at Colours, they absolutely nail that. Like you say, it, you still feel like you're engaging the content, but doing it in a quirky and unusual way. You don't feel like you're being slapped around the face with designers trying to show you how clever they are.
I like the idea of design has gone too far. It sounds like a TV programme I watch late at night one evening. Would you ever worry about appearing on that, you know, design has gone too far? Or do you think that it's actually fairly easy as long as you keep your discipline and, crucially, something you both said, stick to your, you know, overarching vision? You can actually avoid making those kind of blunders.
Yeah, I think you've always got to be sort of really, really switched on about sort of the design decisions you're making, because as you go through and you design the content and you're making these decisions, you kind of look at it and you go like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we did this? And it's like, well, what does that add? You know, what are we getting from this? Why are we making that decision?
I think what James has hit on there is the most important question in any aspect of magazine publishing, which is why, you know, why are we telling these particular stories? Why are we doing this with the design visually? You know, what's the point of it? Up to the, you know, the higher scale, which is why are we publishing this magazine? You know, what are we putting this out into the world to do? And I think we get sent an awful lot of magazines and it's fantastic and we get to see them and flick through them. But sometimes you do wonder if people have, you know, maybe launched them because they like the idea of having a magazine. They haven't answered those why questions. And I think I hope it's something we're pretty good at in quite a positive, supportive way, is to keep questioning things. I think if once you stop doing that, again, I think you start to get into difficulties.
Asking the fundamental questions. Why and how? That's what we like to do here on The Stack. That's Rob Alderson and James Cartwright, my guests here on this week's Stack. And we'll continue to delve into their stacks of magazines on the programme right after this. Music. As promised, next on the stack, we'll be checking in with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. He is presently in St. Moritz. He's also been in Milan, and that is what I shall ask him about first of all. Tyler, good morning. Welcome to the programme. You've just been at Salone, then, in Milan. What did you find there? What about the state of the design magazine marketplace?
Well, the design magazine marketplace is, of course, a very busy one. Interesting on one side because, you know, so many titles want to, of course, get their name out there. So you have sort of, you can almost sort of be crushed in an avalanche of free titles. So that's one part of it. Then at the same time, of course, you just have so many journalists. I mean, really, the great, good, not so good of the international design media scene are all on hand from all over the world. One thing you would have noticed this year is just the real surge, Tom, in journalists from Southeast Asia. So it's not just, you know, maybe we would have seen journalists from Singapore before, but, you know, now you've got so many Malaysian titles showing up, Indonesia, also because these are huge growth markets as well. If you look at any of the big Italian brands, when they're looking at new places that they can sell their very large sofas in, their big kitchens, they're really looking for, of course, you know, the big money living in Jakarta, living in KL and elsewhere.
So from all that hustle and bustle of the city in Milan, Tyler, let's clear our heads and head for some nice, fresh Alpine air. How do we find you in St. Moritz? What's the state, of the newsstand there?
One thing that this country does incredibly well, and maybe this is a case for or against monopolies, but there's a national brand called Kiosk in Switzerland. Of course, you can buy magazines in other places, but they tend to be the sole operator. They are part of a bigger group, which is called Valora, who are also very muscular in the German publishing space as well in terms of operating kiosks. So what's quite interesting in Switzerland is that these might look like franchisees, and not because they're necessarily sort of, you know, shabby or better operated, but in many countries, you know, this type of setup is, you know, of course, you pay for the brand name and you pay for the supply, but it's an independent operated venture. In Switzerland, it's all owned and operated by this Basel-based company. So you have a real consistency, and you can go into the tiniest villages. And what I always think is amazing is that aside from, of course, the predictable German, French, and Italian fare that you would find, they're very good at also honing in on the local tastes and markets. Of course, if you're in St. Moritz, you have, for example, a very large Portuguese community. There's a lot of Portuguese people working in the service sector here. So the newsstand will have, you know, a sizable collection of magazines, both from Portugal and from Brazil. Likewise, of course, you have a lot of Russians skiing here as well. So there is, you know, there's a strong Russian mix of magazines. And then, of course, just a full range of English titles as well. Of course, with our fine title, you know, very much pushed to the front of the newsstand.
Good to see that prominent as always, Tyler. I shall leave you to the rest of your day, Tyler. Just briefly, where might we find you next week, perhaps? I don't know where your next globe-trotting spot is.
I think that we could probably be chatting from the ISDN line in our Zurich office. Not a very big trip, Tom, just 2 hours down the mountain. So we'll be checking in then.
Fantastic. That's Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief, joining me on The Stack. Tyler, thank you very much indeed. Last week on The Stack, we had a close look at the thriving independent magazine sector, hearing from the Facing Pages Biennale in Arnhem in the Netherlands. This week, it's time to look at the big bad world of news journalism and the printed daily. Last month, academics and senior journalists from all over the world gathered in Thessaloniki, Greece, to talk about journalism in transition. High on the agenda was the new role for the printed editions. Our contributor, Sakis Ioannidis, was there. He found out it's not always bad news coming from the presses.
I would like to present to you some journalistic suggestions.
The media landscape and journalism transformations seem to be a great field of research, as more than 140 academics gathered for a two-day conference in Thessaloniki to discuss whether the current state of journalism foretells for a gloomier future, or if there's a bright side of things. Browsing through the conference agenda, you notice a special interest of scholars to online media and the changes in the way journalists work and report the news. Professor Robert Picard of the Oxford University says over a cup of coffee that there's room for everyone if they take up their new roles in society.
Newspapers that have for the last 30, 40 years published 6-7 days a week, some of them are now going back to 5 days a week, even 4, some have gone to 3, but then they're using the digital media to do the daily updates and to do the current material for their audiences. And that is a new way of working, but it's a way that really reduces costs and actually allows you to interact with your customer much better than you did before. If you're a company that thinks I'm only a magazine publisher, no, you're not. You're a publisher, content creator that helps people's lives, that informs them, that tells them about the things they want to know about, that helps them better enjoy their sports or their lifestyles or other such things.
Over a short break for lunch, the talks among the scholars vary from revenue sources in online media to how newspapers have changed their practices and writing styles to adapt to a new visual-oriented era. For several years now, advertisers were drawn away from the pages of newspapers in an effort to reach a more specific audience. This need is met by magazines, as Professor Thomas Hanitz from the University of Munich says, adding that magazines' superior advantage is their role as society's sidekick advisors.
For magazines, I think that is the only meaningful segment of the market that still has potential to grow, especially in areas of lifestyle, news you can do, providing orientation about products, consumption, about ways of life, because I have a strong guess that as society is losing more and more faith in the traditional institutions of school or education in general, family, churches, these are the traditional institutions that have provided collective orientations. And as these institutions cease to provide this orientation, the media take over. And for advertisers, it's much more convenient because they can address a very specific audience of which they know who they are. It's sometimes often difficult for advertisers in general newspapers because the audience is so fuzzy. It's so distributed. You have so many different kinds of people that if you have an expensive car and you post an advertising in a newspaper, you might reach maybe only 5% of the audience. But if you put in an advertising in automotive magazine, you will reach all people you need. So this is why magazines are thriving.
The conference organized by the European Communication Research and Education Association with the contribution of the local Faculty of Journalism from the Aristotle's University finished raising much more questions than those answered. Journalism is definitely in transition, and opportunities are created from the unsettled and those who seek them. Technology affects the work of journalists in many ways, as it does with the majority of professions, but this also marks progress. The print industry might never be the same again, but new roles are emerging. Reporting the news should always be a necessity, and good stories are worth to be told. Adaptation might be the key. For Monocle 24 in Thessaloniki, Greece, I'm Sakis Ioannidis.
That was our man in Greece, Sakis Ioannidis, reporting from the Journalism in Transition conference in Thessaloniki. You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and my special guests today, Rob Alderson and James Cartwright of Printed Pages magazine. We've been, we started to delve into your stacks. There's still so many more to discover. Rob, your turn next. Where should we turn our attentions?
I've got an absolute obsession of a new magazine, so I'm going to gush probably quite embarrassingly about this. So just
embarrassing gushing. More than welcome.
Okay, fantastic. Always a good rule for life there. This is Zeit magazine, which is the very popular, very well-known Zeit magazine, Die Zeit magazine, which is obviously a German weekly publication. This is a new international edition they've started doing. This is the second issue that's just come out. And it came from the fact that lots of people said, oh, we love the kind of people you get. They have amazing access and they do amazing things, but it's all in German. And lots of people were saying, well, we can't engage with that because we don't speak German. So they made the very, what seems like a very simple idea to say, well, why don't we pull together some of the best content and a couple of times of the year publish it in English? And this is it, Zeit magazine, and it is just the most joyous magazine I've come across for ages. And I mean that really in terms of, you know, it is beautiful, it's very nicely put together, but more than anything it's the content. And of course they've got a bit of a head start because they're pulling from, you know, a huge back catalogue of amazing content, which Zeit have always done. But I think what it does brilliantly for me is the stuff it brings together. I mean, you know, here you've got a feature on Ai Weiwei's Instagram pictures, and it just pulls together a load of really interesting examples. A very kind of interestingly written article about the relationship between Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, and François Hollande, the French President. Something I don't think I'm interested in, but I think that's what magazines at their best. It's that serendipity of, yes, you would never Google, I would never, you know, try and Google an article about Angela Merkel and François Hollande, but put in front of me and written as well as this, I really did. And the one that I'm absolutely obsessed with, there is an amazing article by a writer called Angela Kockwitz, who has written a piece about, in China, ghost marriage, where if young men die and they're unmarried, what families, some kind of traditional families do, is find women, young girls who have died around the same time, and they essentially have a marriage for them, and they Photoshop pictures of them together and make wedding photos. And it is something that's blown my mind. I've gone on and on about it. James is bored of hearing me talk about this because it's all I've talked about for about a week is this article.
You have talked about it a lot.
I know I have. But
he's disguising his boredom well. He looks pretty engaged still.
But it just feels like I enjoy everything in here. I think that, you know, and quite often we get asked, you know, perhaps people who are on courses or university ask, you know, what's the secret to my magazine publishing? You know, what's the really important thing? And I always hammer on about content. Content, content, content. You know, without that, you're nothing. I know Richard Turley says very similar things, is that people don't buy magazines for good design. And he's an amazing designer. They buy it for good content. And this is the best example. It's the one I will give out and use as the great example of this done well, because this is just interesting, engaging, fun, exciting. And yeah, is that enough gushing?
I think that's just about. I will stop you there. But it's interesting though, because it is more of a sort of a curated piece almost. Looking back, as you said, it's the fillets of an impressive stable already of things to choose from, which perhaps makes their job a little easier. But that idea of curated, carefully, you know, sort of maintained, readers trust, don't they? The people who make the magazines they like to exert that taste, that judgment, and to bring things together for them. Do you think that it's important, that role as a sort of curator of ideas, be they the written word, of course, or in terms of great design? It's not just your own creative vision. It's about sort of pooling together other things, James, and showing your readers, you know, the things that you like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's what people sort of buy into when they become regular readers or subscribers to a particular magazine. It's sort of like they start to trust your viewpoint and they start to kind of understand what it is they're going to get from you. And I think it's really important to be very much aware of that relationship all the time when you're putting things together, is that, you know, what is it that we've set out to do? What are we giving people? What are they expecting from us? And making sure that you kind of always consider that and sort of, you know, are pulling in those influences and references from all over to create a sort of a holistic final product.
And also, once you've got people buying into that curation, not only is it's a huge responsibility, you have to take that very seriously, but it also opens up this whole world of possibilities and opportunities. Because if they trust your taste and your eye and your integrity as much as anything, then of course, can you then do an events program? Can you do a talks evening? Can you have a pub where they trust your curation on the kind of things that they'll come across in the pub? You know, and it makes publishing this very interesting, suddenly very ephemeral, all bets are off kind of world. And I think that's something we're really excited about. What are the possibilities, once people have bought into that you can then develop and evolve from there?
There's a lot of exciting opportunities, and we explore some of them, of course, here at Monocle as well in that respect. Over a coffee at our cafe, perhaps afterwards, we can mull over the implications of that. James, let's continue our sort of global magazine journey then. Where shall we turn next? What have you got there? That's caught my eye instantly.
It would do, because it's massive. It's a new title called Noon, which has been put together by Jasmine Rasnahan, who's a London-based designer and editor. And it landed on our desk on Monday morning, and I was just
with quite a thud.
It's a weighty tome. But it's just very, very beautiful, and I've not had an enormous amount of time to kind of really dig into the content. But as kind of a very considered piece of aesthetics, it's jaw dropping.
Is it an art magazine? Is it sort of an arts and markets magazine? What do we sort of understand its position in the marketplace? Really,
I think it's very much sort of a photography focused title. So there's kind of Wolfgang Tillmans is in there as the sort of as the top spot, but it seems like a sort of a very considered, curated photography magazine.
I'm sold. This is my first. Sorry, I'm just browsing through it now. Just lost in a bit of a
just
reverie.
Lost in it. But that's what happened when it came in on Monday.
Even smells nice, doesn't it?
That's great.
Rob, what do you make of Noon? Do you think is that a welcome addition to a? I mean, it's a busy marketplace, but a welcome addition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the key thing for me here is the respect that they give the imagery. And I think again, that sounds like an obvious thing to say, but you do come across titles and things are squeezed, or you know, people trying, like we talked about earlier, trying to be too clever with it. I think there's a great piece on Michael Wolff's photography, which we featured on the site before, which is a kind of high-rise buildings in Hong Kong. It's the respect they pay to it. You know, you get these kind of snapshots and then suddenly you get this amazing double-page spread, just kind of blue and pink tower blocks. And it just, it shows you, you know, I don't want to go into the whole kind of like why magazines are better than online type thing, but it's one of those kind of jaw-dropping, breathtaking moments that's like, yes, this can never be done on an iPad. This can never be done on your phone. This, you have to lose yourself in the physical sensation of this and what it's doing. And so for me, yeah, I mean, really interested to see how they move forward. There's no ads in it. So, you know, I think with my very hard-nosed editor-in-chief advert, I'm interested what their business model is. So it'd be interesting to see how it goes forward over time.
James, just before we finish, just on that point, within the sort of independent magazine sector, is there enough time? Are people afforded enough time to experiment, to make errors, to sort of hone their craft, to make sure they get things right? Because it's not always easy to, you know, get everything right absolutely in your first issue. And in fact, a lot of the best ideas tend to be the product of, if not errors, then of that sort of evolution. Do you think that there is enough space in the marketplace for people to be a little experimental and to put, you know, what are potentially great ideas through a bit of a trial and error period?
I think potentially there isn't, but people need to make sure that they kind of make time for that and are kind of prepared to sort of spend time thinking about how they're going to develop and how they're going to kind of address things that become sort of problems in early issues. Because the reality is you're never going to put out a first issue and have it be perfect for what you want to achieve. You know, it's always going to be evolving. You're always going to be adapting it and making sure that it does all of the things that you want it to do. And along the way, if you make mistakes, fair enough. And I think it's about knowing that you've got sort of a hardcore group of fans behind you that are going to support you and understand those changes that you need to make to kind of develop and suit their needs as best you can, really.
And I think to be honest about that with your readers, you know, we make a thing. Someone kind of took the mickey out of me recently about my editor's letters at the start. They're always very honest, kind of saying what we didn't do so well, what we've learned. But actually, I think that's fine. I think let's have that dialogue with the readers. They are hopefully along with the journey on this. And I think let's get them into this process of giving us the time and the patience to experiment, to get some things wrong, and hopefully develop a much better end product through that process.
Those are the insights of Rob Alderson and before that James Cartwright from Printed Pages magazine. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Stack. That brings us, sadly, to the end of this edition. Edition 85 of the programme with me, Tom Edwards. Our producer was David Pleasant, behind the glass here at Midori House. As ever, our attentive studio manager, Claire Urban. If you have any comments, queries, please make them be polite. Drop us a note, info@monocle.com. Remember, we'll return at the same time next weekend, of course. And you can always listen again to the show at monocle.com via iTunes or SoundCloud too. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, that is all from The Stack. Until next time, goodbye.